Yeah, I love that idea. I mean, it's so rich, that classic feminist slogan, the personal is political. I think that when second wave feminists were saying that, part of what they were saying is the supposed liberation movements they were in that would just be like, yeah, don't talk about women's issues. Don't talk about what happens in the bedroom or who does the dishes or who changes the diapers. That's your personal problem. And people were like, actually, no, this is a political condition where women are forced to do all the reproductive labor. And they politicized these areas. And second wave feminists really brought attention to domestic and interpersonal violence and rape and said, we've been told this doesn't matter or isn't important or is our personal issue. And actually, this is a huge political condition of the entire society. We live in a rape culture. So they said, let's bring the spotlight to these areas that have been considered private or behind the fence or whatever.
Constantly about policing women's bodies, we're slut-shaming women. Mm-hmm. And that's what my work's about, women owning agency, any kind. And that's what makes me really excited, having agency, sexual agency, owning sexuality, not being an object of it.
Well, it changes all the time. I think beauty is, for me, what I find really beautiful is something fresh, something I've never seen before. Or, you know, or the natural kit and sunset. I can find things to make a fresh vision from. That's what I'm interested in. Oh, I don't really look for inspiration. I just let it come to me. Mm-hmm. But I don't stop working. Work comes from work. So when I'm stuck, I just keep working and make terrible looking things until something else comes out of it. That's a creative process. Work comes from work. You can't think yourself out of right action. You have to act yourself into right thinking. You can't sit there and smoke cigarettes and look at the wall waiting for inspiration.
Yeah, that's true. It's a physical labor.
It's a physical labor. You move a muscle, change a thought.
Part of what I think is important for young people to know is that there are a lot of different ways to embody different gender categories. And being in a context in which your value is not tied to making very specific decisions about your gender is a healthier context overall. We have a lot of evidence to support that claim, that children who are facilitated in expressing their gender nonconforming identities are healthier and happier than children who don't have those opportunities. But we don't have a problem with telling children stories about heterosexuality, right? School libraries are full of books where the woman and the man get married and they have babies and maybe they go to church. So we are always telling children stories. So the idea that not telling them these stories is not influencing them, I think is incorrect. It is telling them that there is only one way to be, that is acceptable, that is recognizable, that is among the stories that we have at our disposal. And I think it's really important to really look at that particular framework, that there is a way in which we are influencing children if we give them this information, but not if we don't. And that is incorrect, because then every story that they are confronted with is a story of a gender normative person. And that is very, very psychologically damaging to children who are not gender normative inside themselves. There are also different ways of thinking about this. One is about trans stories, like here's a book with a trans character in it. Another is statements that are consistent with what feminists have been saying for decades, which is there are a lot of different ways for girls to be. There are a lot of different ways for boys to be. And then simply just adding onto the end of that. And then there are some people who don't feel like a girl or a boy. Or some people who are assigned one gender category at birth and feel like a different one, and that is also a fine way to be.
I think that there's a lot of different ways to be a feminist. I think choices is much more academic, at least in the beginning, without any real world experience, and it's just kind of divorced from the practicalities of life. I think I would consider myself not a second wave feminist, especially in terms of my views on pornography and sex work and women's sexuality. I think that really was the chasm that divided feminists in the late 70s. And I think I'm trying to do that with Joyce, kind of show her journey from maybe being judgmental or wanting to protect these women to realizing that that's like a valid form of commerce and expression. My mother was a doctor and one of the few female doctors in her hospital when I was growing up, but I just don't know that she wouldn't have called herself a feminist. I think in the 80s, it was kind of an ugly word. You didn't want to be branded that way. So I think that if anything, I would be the polar opposite of how I grew up. I did do a lot of research on second wave feminism. I think that it was just a necessary part of feminism. That's what it needed to be at that time. I'm personally glad that it evolved and continues to evolve.
one of our big hopes with the adaptation. That's very much what we hope people will take away from the experience, is that they don't feel quite so alone. And I think that one of the things that was so powerful about the book is women were reading and able to experience and step into the inner lives of these women. And also to show that a housewife in Indiana who isn't being kissed, a young woman who is taken advantage of and abused by her teacher, who now is speaking up for herself, but she's in North Dakota and she's a waitress who works at Perkins, that these women deserve to be heard and that they count and their stories count and matter as much as anybody else's. And I think that's something else that the show is saying to the women that are watching, is that your life matters. You don't have to be some aspirational, gorgeous person, although Sloan absolutely is that character. So there's someone for beautiful, aspirational women out in the world as well. But for other women living in the Midwest and having struggles and feeling like, who is seeing me and do I matter? Hopefully the mirror of Lena and the mirror of Maggie will really help them not feel so alone and to know that their stories are really important and really matter. And that was something we talked about a lot, and we're excited to explore the way these narratives, these stories in pop culture, these movies can really influence the way we think our lives should look. And I don't think we come down on one side or the other, but I think show both how sometimes it can lead you astray. We all have these narratives and these stories that we've internalized, and it was to dramatize both the dark and the light of what that relationship to those stories can look like was something we were really excited to do in the show.
And as we began to tell Diane's story, we realized that her story was so intrinsically linked with the history and politics and culture of the world, whether it was Europe in the 1950s and 60s or America in the 70s and 80s. And so we felt that while we were telling Diane's story, we also wanted to tell the bigger story of what was happening in the world at that time. And so you see that when you watch the film, there are many layers to the film, whether it's graphics or music or archival footage that we have used or photographs that we've used. Together, they weave a story of what it was like to live at that time.
The feminist killjoy, in a way, begins as a stereotype of feminists, those miserable feminists who make misery their mission. And in reclaiming that figure, I'm following on from many other acts of political reclaimings of terms that maybe begin their lives as insults or as sneers, as well as stereotypes. I think of the word queer. So the term is used to dismiss feminism as motivated by misery or by the desire to cause misery. And in reclaiming that figure, you're not agreeing with the idea that feminists are miserable. Luckily, I don't think that is the case. Rather, what we're saying is, well, if feminism causes misery, if talking about sexism or racism, forms of power, inequality, violence causes misery, then that is what we are willing to cause. And that's why in the book itself, I wrap the book around these kind of killjoy commitments. And one of the primary ones is simply, I'm willing to cause unhappiness, because so many forms of social inequality and social violence, in effect, hard to speak about, hard to address, hard to make real even, because as soon as you name them, you're treated as if you've brought them into existence. As soon as you name the problem, you become the problem. And so the act of reclaiming the feminist killjoy really requires a lot of political solidarity. It's very hard to do that on your own. It's very hard to cause the unhappiness of others on your own. You actually end up on a journey that allows you to connect to other people, other killjoys. And that's part of why killing joy becomes world-making in my language.
There's a part of me that feels like being slightly marginalized makes me hungrier. Well, I was 19 and I had this bastardized glamour. My mother was a drug addict, and there were pictures of high-end addiction, and most people aren't used to seeing that. They're used to seeing drug addicts on the street, a needle in their arm or something.
You know? Yeah, there's a glamour. Is it painful to take photos like that? Or
no, because I don't see what you see. I just see mom. My brothers and I have no idea what you guys see. How would we? Why do people like these photos so much? Why are they so intense? I have to try and mirror them, see them through other people's eyes. I never got Mm-hmm. We never got it. How? That's all we knew.
I say to myself or to anyone who's taking care of my mother right now, some kind of spirit, wherever she is, I am just saying that I'm grateful that she raised me this way. And I guess one thing that she taught me, or just her whole presence taught me, was to really appreciate the knowledge created by generations of women before me. So it wasn't just my mother. I started to look at my grandmothers as well, and how they actually had the knowledge, but the society just couldn't appreciate the knowledge, or that knowledge wasn't seen as knowledge. Part of my work that I do now is to work with a feminist collective to actually question knowledge production and who is excluded from it, who is being marginalized because of it. And I guess my mother played a great role in steering me to that direction, not just my mother, but also the generations of women before me. And now I'm really into excavating the works of women writers from the past that didn't get attention or were erased due to certain affiliations. That's a lot of things that my mother taught me.
People are like, oh, well, dating isn't serious. It's not a serious thing to talk about, or sex. I think in queer culture, it's a bit different. But in a lot of our lives, the real political issues are just like, you know, let's talk about the Affordable Care Act and let's talk about fracking. But let's not talk about the fact that in our meetings, people are relating with each other and people are being sexually unethical in our movements and it's causing disruption or harm. Or also that we experience very significant suffering in our lives in these relationships, and that it matters, and that it's related to huge political systems that keep us all in our places by scripting very narrow roles for us that are gendered and racialized and all that stuff. A script like the romance myth is insidious. It's in people's heads in many unpredictable and unexpected ways. It's propaganda, right? And we're told it's natural.
I was thinking back to what led me to the figure of the Killjoy, and it's really because I was writing about happiness. And I was writing about happiness in part because I was so struck when I was doing this project on diversity within universities about how many diversity practitioners offered really strong critique of the ways in which diversity itself was used as a kind of happiness mission. One practitioner called it a big shiny apple. It all looks wonderful, but the inequalities aren't being addressed. So I came to happiness to offer a critique of happiness, and the Killjoy came to me then, partly because I had these memories myself of being assigned her, of being positioned as her, the one that was ruining the dinner, as my mum would say, for talking about sexism or speaking back to my father. So I wanted to write a book that would be a trade book. And although I think of myself as a feminist teacher, I also really committed to feminist ideas circulating as widely and as wildly as possible.
As a filmmaker, I've always made films about extraordinary women whose lives are faced with extenuating circumstances, who've had adversity thrown at them, and who've risen to the occasion. And when I began to look at Diane's story, for me, Diane is a fashion designer, but she's so much more. And like her central ethos, which is woman before fashion, we felt it was very important to take that central ethos and weave that into the spine of our film and make this film about the woman at the heart of our film. It is also a film about, you know, four generations of women. It's about Diane's mother, it's about Diane, it's about Diane's daughter and her granddaughter. And we wanted all those voices in the film. Her family was incredible in that they allowed us into the inner sanctum of their lives. From the first time we sat down with Diane, she's such a natural storyteller that she began at her birth, which was a triumph because her mother had come out of Auschwitz only 18 months before she was born.
I was always curious about sex from an early age, and my father was kind of a home nudist. My brother and older sister and I were all bathed in the same bathtub together until my sister entered puberty. We thought it was fun. We were just in the bathtub playing with our toys and laughing. We'd be in there for an hour. And so I was familiar with nudity, but I always had a curiosity about it. And in the 1960s, there was the hippie movement and the free sex movement, the idea that sex and love were intertwined, that sex should be free, that feminism was sex positive, that women should have the right to orgasms, women should have the right to control their bodies, that women should make sexual demands. It was an exhilarating time. And so the pornography that existed then was upbeat.
It was friendly. It was men and women working together to make something that seemed like it was actually going to better humankind. And that's how I got into it. As we went on, however, through the 70s and then into the 80s, in the 80s, it got very commercial. And once it got commercial, it began to get less fun. Then they were crunching the numbers and saying, oh, this is what sells. You have to do this. And the creativity was disappearing, which is how I got into doing these niche magazines, these fetish magazines.
I think finding the meaning in the work, I have to. That's what it, for me, without the meaning, I don't know why we would really want to tell stories without being connected to the meaning. And I also think that, especially for women, but I do think for human beings, that is how we do be able to work as hard as we do and be able to get up the next morning and keep going, right? Is because we're working through the meaning, and it actually feeds us as we're like making sense of it all, trying to make sense of it. And being in community and in communion, if I dare say that as an ex-Catholic, to like be sharing a witness of what it is to be human and what it means, and through this work to tell our stories. So yeah, I feel like it's a bit of a crushing experience as an industry goes. And I often feel like I'm way flung out to the side in the process of how I do the work versus how the industry wants it done, expects it done, and how the money is made and having it done. But I kind of don't care because I get one life that I'm aware of. And I just want to do it in a way that feels really good and the art feels true for me.
The Creative Process Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. We hope you've enjoyed this program. To hear more from these guests, listen to their full interviews. These interviews were conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. This episode was produced by Mia Funk and Tom Logan. Associate Interviews producer was Jaden Van. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community, exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just drop us a line at team@creativeprocess.info. Thanks for listening.